Les colloques du Collège de France.
So, I mean, the afternoon ahead will give us the opportunity to hear from four very different personalities: Isabelle Ahmad, Hoda Fakhreddin, Diana Allen, and Mahmoud Eshaal, each with their own unique story and committed to a project that expresses their own intellectual or artistic vision. Yet, they are united by a profound commonality, not that of a journalistic message, and even less that of a slogan or convenient label. Rather, each of them tenaciously and subtly questions categories that they do not consider innocent, and which they therefore refuse to accept as imposed on them from outside and once and for all. For them, the categories of place, of time, of memory and forgetting, of historical depth and turning points constitute multiple threads which suddenly make the mental space of historians, novelists, poets, and even politicians and ideologues deeply intelligible. This gives rise to fruitful reflections on the relationship between the particular, in this case, the current situation in Palestine, and the universal, that of the Arab world, its culture and history, and that of global humanity, of which the Arab world is a part. If there is one certainty after reading them, it is this: the current Palestinian tragedy engages the meaning of what we will understand in the times to come by the word humanity, granted, of course, that the word humanity will still have any tolerable meaning in a few decades' time. That being said, I would like to introduce our first speaker of the afternoon, Isabelle Ahmad. So Isabelle is both one of the most promising, or rather already established, novelists in the English-speaking world. Her novels have won several awards and won over a wide audience, and an essayist who has taken up the torch from Edouard Said. In her first novel, The Parisian, 2019, acclaimed by the most demanding critics, she paints a picture of a world in crisis between the end of the Ottoman Empire, the beginning of Arab nationalism, and the European Belle Époque. In her second novel, the masterpiece Enter Ghost, 2023, Hamlet le long du mur, in the French translation, she explores issues related to Palestinian identity and modern history with unparalleled depth. Her latest essay, The Brilliant Recognizing the Stranger on Palestine and Narrative, from 2024, while allowing her own voice as a great artist to be heard, shows that she also has all the sharpness of Said when it comes to denouncing colonial pretenses. But above all, she masterfully plays with the concept of recognition, the Aristotelian anagnorisis, dear to my heart and central to Aristotle's poetics. This dual skill, poetry is never very far from history in Isabelle Ahmad's literary universe, is all the more remarkable given that her novels, while delicate, are not didactic, and her essays have all the rigor one would expect from historical science. Isabella therefore presents a rare intellectual profile where intelligence is combined with courage, and we are very happy to hear her speak today in Paris.
Thank you, Marwan, for that very, very kind introduction. And thank you for having me. I feel that some of the material that I'm going to talk about is a little bit kind of repetitious or echoes things we've heard this morning, but from the perspective of poetry and literature. But perhaps that weave, that repetition, is part of the point of us being here. Thank you, Didier, for bringing us together. And Mahmoud, we wish you were with us in person. In his memoir, I Saw Ramallah, the Palestinian poet Mourid Barghouti recounts returning to the West Bank in the mid-1990s after the Oslo Accords, an agreement between Israel and the PLO that Edward Said famously described as the Palestinian Versailles. Inaugurating a misleadingly titled peace process, the terms of the agreement permitted many Palestinians in exile to return to the land that would apparently one day become a Palestinian state. History proved Saeed right. The limited autonomy for the Palestinians provisioned by Oslo ultimately enabled an entrenchment of Israeli occupation and apartheid, and has in part led us to where we are today. For Barghouti at the time, the return to his homeland was bittersweet. It meant confronting not the idea of Palestine, but the place itself. Arriving in his ancestral town, Deir Hassani, he finds the buildings he knew from childhood still standing, and remarks, in this translation by Ahdaf Suif, "Buildings are not the only things destroyed by time. The imagination of the poet is preordained for destruction. Suddenly, my imagination collapses like a building." Barghouti is playing here upon the motif of standing on the ruins, al-wukuf al-al-atlal, a motif that is as old as the oldest versions of the qasida or ode, which is itself the oldest of Arabic poetic forms. The traditional qasida begins with a prelude called the nasib, which features particular motifs. These include recalling the departed caravan and the vanished beloved, and standing upon the ruins of the abandoned campsite and weeping. Subversions of the motif of standing on the ruins are almost as old as the motif itself. But whether it is being riffed upon or summoned sincerely, any mention of al-atlal in Arabic literature and the visual arts immediately invokes an ancient literary heritage stretching all the way back to the seven canonical mu'allaqat, or hanging odes, of the pre-Islamic Jahiliyyah period. The 6th century poet king Imr al-Qais began his mu'allaqa with the words, "Qifa nabki ala, sorry, min dhikra habibi wa manzili, bisiqt liwa bayna dukhul fahumali. Halt, two friends, and we will weep for the memory of one beloved and an abode at the edge of the dune between Adakhul and Haumal." The opening imperative verb stop or halt is in the dual form. Suzanne Stetkevich has translated it as halt, two friends, while other scholars have suggested that the two being addressed here are the poet's sword and his steed. Either way, the weeping is explicitly not solitary. Both within the framework of the poem and in relation to the listener or reader, this is a public show of grief. Syrian poet and critic Adonis writes that Imr al-Qais, quote, announces his presence by talking of an absence, i.e. through weeping memory. And the weeping happens upon a stage where he asks his friends to share in it. And while the poem here is apparently addressing only two people, its deeper meaning points to those who sympathize with the poet in this experience and to everyone who has known a similar experience, end quote. From the very earliest appearances of the poetic nasib, the loss of a particular beloved was always also a figure for communal grief over the ravages of time. In itinerant life, time's passage is marked geographically. Standing on the ruins for the pre-Islamic Bedouin poet is a point of departure both verbally, the customary prelude to the rest of the poem, and physically, as the poet, and by extension, his or her people, move on from the site of the abandoned encampment. In English, ruins signifies the remains of an architectural structure that has been ruined by the natural effect of time and weather or suddenly destroyed by man, while the Arabic atlal, singular talal, is translated variously as ruins or traces, its root relates to the act of looking or looking out upon. From talla we have to emerge, to rise, to loom up, come into view, to command a view of, to overlook, to look out, or peek out upon. And from there we have that which rises into view, that which remains standing. Etymologically in Arabic, these material traces of the past are there to be looked at. Freud once suggested that to look at ruins might be an analogue for the work of good psychoanalysis. In Civilization and His Discontents, he argues that the traces of our past experiences lie mixed together in our psyches, just as Rome contains the architectural remnants of all of its various histories, by which, quote, everything is somehow preserved and in suitable circumstances can once more be brought to light. Only a paragraph later, however, Freud changes his mind about his choice of metaphor. He decides that, after all, the normality and frequency of demolitions and replacements of buildings in cities, even during peaceful periods, make them, quote, a priori unsuited for a comparison of this sort with a mental organism, end quote. Rather than an analogue for the work of psychoanalysis, looking at the ruins strikes me as a better analogue for the work of mourning. Proper mourning requires a person to acknowledge what exactly they have lost, as Freud argued in his text on the subject, Mourning and Melancholia. If a loss is not brought into the full light of consciousness, grief curdles into melancholia. Stopping to perceive the traces of what is there no longer, then, precisely enacts the psychic movement of looking, acknowledging, and then eventually separating. Centuries before the development of the discipline of psychoanalysis and its discursive equipment, the Jahiliya poet's call to stand on the ruins and weep before moving on from the site of loss was a poeticized communal version of an interior mental process. According to Melanie Klein, who developed out of Freud's work on mourning the concept of the infantile depressive position, a child's psychological probing of the external world involves the ultimately shattering understanding that his or her loved objects are impermanent. This key stage in the child's development is a template for all subsequent experiences of grief. If the baby can tolerate the first loss of the mother's breast, it develops the capacity to think. Confronted finally with the mother's separateness, the child is cast out at sea and painfully becomes an individual. Healthy mourning is grounded in the ability to separate. I do not own the objects of my love, nor are they perfect, nor are they part of me. I cannot control them. Crucially, mourning requires a person, whether as a child or as an adult, to recognize that they are not omnipotent, that they are capable of being bad and of having destructive thoughts. In other words, mourning involves not only coming to terms with your lost or departed loved object or beloved, but also with your own vulnerability and finitude. In Klein's model, what you get in exchange for mourning your own omnipotence is not just a confrontation with the bitterness of life, as Freud had it, but a richer experience of living, and above all, the ability to love. I think the impulse to make art often begins with looking at ruins and traces, what Adrienne Rich called diving into the wreck in her poem of that title, whose speaker is an underwater archaeologist wearing mask and flippers. And I suspect this is the case even when the wreckage looking is not obvious to the reader or viewer, when the text or artwork travels far from that original site of pain, or when it transforms into something else. I do not mean to say that all art is reparative, nor do I believe that writing poetry is necessarily therapeutic, although I don't doubt that for some people it might be, nor that it frequently involves a healthful processing of loss. Literary writing might as easily be an expression of melancholic avoidance, like me writing this paper, or obsessive repetition, or an ideological instrument or projection of fantasy, or any combination of these things and more. Still, loss strikes me as a common starting point, and from this point of stopping to look at mortality and the passing of time, a writer can launch off into other zones and climes. In the Qasida, the Nasib literally gives way to the Rahil, the poet's crossing of the desert, followed by the Fakhr, the boast of the warrior and his tribe, and sometimes the panegyric, or Madih. An ancient correlate to this pattern in the visual arts might take us to the story recounted by Pliny the Elder of the so-called Corinthian maid, who in 600 BC supposedly outlined her lover's shadow on the wall in chalk before he left for battle. Her father, a potter, developed from this primitive silhouette the art of modeling clay in relief. His daughter's original drawing might mark an early instance in the Western tradition of a trace of the departed as a spring for mimetic art, a tlal of another kind. The trace that both presences an absence and reminds us that it is gone at the same time. Traces and ruins persisted in Arabic poetry into the 20th century, but with less frequency and more figuratively. After all, centuries had passed since the age of the itinerant bard packing up his tent, and with the spread of modernist ideas into Arabic literary writing, the strict formal properties of the Qasida began to disintegrate. Still, the motif recurred, referentially, sometimes reverently. In Umm Kulthum's renowned song Al-Atlal, based on the poem by Ibrahim Naji, the ruins are explicitly those of romantic love. Ya fu'adi la tasal ayn al-hawa, ken sarhan min khayalin fahawa. Oh my heart, don't ask where is the passion, it was an imaginary castle, so it fell. When this record was released in the late 1960s, many interpreted the lyrics to be referring not to a failed romance, but to Israel's defeat of the Arab armies in the June 1967 war. The collapsed imaginary castle was not the fantasy of the beloved, but the dream of Arab unity and the imminent liberation of Palestine. There was reasonable grounds for such a reading. Amid the continuing battle for liberation from Western imperialism and Zionism after the formal decolonization of much of the Third World, many Arab poets were applying their pen to their political and social realities, compelled by an atmosphere of commitment or iltizam. Writing after the disaster of 67, the celebrated love poet Nizar Qabbani described being transformed from the poet writing of love and longing to a poet writing with a knife. Many Palestinian poets have made use of the trope to address the 1948 Nakba, the massacre and dispossession of Palestinians by Zionist forces which enabled the founding of the Israeli state, of which the material traces are still to be found in the ruins of Palestinian houses, often on the edges of cities or hidden beneath forests of pine trees planted by the Jewish National Fund. From Rashid Hussein's Yafa in Al-Hub Al-Jito to Fawzi Bakri's Jerusalem in Al Al-Atlal Al-Madina, to Mahmoud Darwish's Talaliyat al-Birwa, in which he invokes Imr al-Qais's well-known dual imperative to halt at the wreckage of his demolished village and explicitly alludes to the tropes of the Mu'allaqat of the Jahiliyyah. These writers do not mourn tents or temporary dwellings from which they have naturally departed, but the homes and towns from which they have been forcibly displaced, buildings that have since been destroyed or appropriated. Fadwa Tuqan opens her elegy for Yafa, I will not cry, lan abki. على أبواب يافا يا أحبائي وفي فوضى حطام الدور بين الردم والشوكي وقفت وقلت للعينين قف نبكي على أطال من رحلوا وفاتوها تنادي من بناها الدار وتنع من بناها الدار. At the gates of Yafa, my loves, and in the chaos of the destroyed houses, amidst the rubble and thorns, I stopped and said to my two eyes, stop, let us weep. Over the ruins of those who have departed and passed away, calling out for those who built the house and mourning for those who built the house. Just as Kulthum's Al-Atlal resounded with the losses of the 67 war, so Tuqan composed this poem in the shadow of that defeat. Israel's expansion of its occupation to include East Jerusalem, the West Bank, and Gaza perversely meant that many Palestinians, including refugees from cities like Haifa and Yafa, were suddenly, if temporarily, reunited with the land from which they had been expelled 19 years earlier. Tuqan's poem narrates this painful opportunity to look upon the ruined houses of Yafa, a city subjected to violent ethnic cleansing in 1948. While both Darwish and Tuqan employ the motif of al-Wuquf al-Atlal to address the devastations wrought by Zionism on Palestinian life, Tuqan pointedly refuses to cry. All of these writers deviate from the structure of the traditional Nasib, placing the ruins in the middle of a poem or at the end or as a recurrent image. The ruins cannot be a point of departure in that older sense. The poet cannot or will not move on. Consolation, the end of mourning, is not possible when a Nakba is ongoing. In the first year alone after the 1967 occupation of the West Bank, East Jerusalem, and Gaza, 7,000 homes were confiscated or demolished, rendering 50,000 people homeless. And the demolition of Palestinian homes has never stopped being an Israeli policy of both punishment and deterrence in a project that seeks to appropriate the land and expel the people. Incomplete or failed mourning, according to Melanie Klein, has pathological consequences. These might include depression, mania, the incapacity to form deep abiding relationships, and a desire to halt time so that the loss cannot be transformed into a past event. What then about loss that cannot by definition be transformed into a past event? Abdul Jawed Omar has written that Palestinians are fighting for the right to mourn and that they live suspended in a collective state of perpetual deferral of this process. Quote, the constancy of loss fractures the temporality essential for mourning, rendering it a luxury unattainable amidst relentless and recurrent bereavement, end quote. There is no framework of pastness for the Nakba, just as there is no post that would permit a diagnosis of post-traumatic stress in those children who, having survived an airstrike, shake uncontrollably on camera. Palestinian mourning has been interrupted acutely in the conditions of the genocide in Gaza, but also chronically in the ongoing obliteration of Palestinian life since 1948. Traditional Western psychoanalytic literature rarely accounts for the ways in which mourning is social, just as giving birth is bodily but also social, bound up in societal norms and practices. In the West, the extinction of culturally ingrained collective mourning practices might be blamed on secularization and even in part on Freud's own foundational essay, Mourning and Melancholia, which so decisively defined mourning as an individual experience confined to the privacy of the mind. Condolence practices are more structured in southern and eastern societies that remain both religiously inflected and more communal. In Islam, the house of condolences is open for 3 days, while widows take 4 months and 10 days to mourn. Islamic and Eastern Christian traditions mark the 40th day after a death, while in Hinduism, visitors attend the grieving for 12. In China and Greece, mourning involves wailing and lamentation among friends and neighbors, and while 3 days, 11 days, 100 days may seem like nothing to the mourner, who may experience a disjuncture between these communal rituals and the wilder psychic life of their grief, the rigidity of the structure can be helpful as a framework, a string of motifs, if you will. While a resistance to consolation might be a collective political act, a refusal to let go of Palestine, the old may die, but the young will not forget. Everyday mourning practices remain crucial nodes of Palestinian sociality and cohesion. Specifically, the emotive and galvanizing power of commemorating the martyr, celebrating the life and sacrifice of a person slain by Israel, renders such funerals a site of communal defiance and revolt. This is a central reason why Israel has for decades sought deliberately to obstruct Palestinian mourning. Israeli state forces repeatedly and violently interrupt funeral processions, for example, and since the 1960s they have maintained a practice of withholding the bodies of Palestinians they have killed, either keeping them refrigerated as a form of torture for the family and a bargaining tool, or in secret burial sites in closed military zones called the cemeteries of numbers. Without the body of the lost loved one, without the proof of death or the possibility of ordinary funerary rites, complete mourning becomes difficult. Israeli police and settlers have historically desecrated Palestinian burial sites and graves, often building parks and other public spaces over them. And in Gaza today, these violations are pushed to an extreme. By the 4th month of the genocide, the army had already destroyed 16 cemeteries, while the sheer volume of casualties has meant expedited burials without the usual procedures of washing the bodies, which are usually laid to rest in mass graves. These are calculated forms of violence inflicted on the psyche of the mourners and on the social body as a whole. When at the end of January 2024, 100 Palestinian corpses were reburied in a mass grave in Rafah, medical sources reported that some had organs missing. On September 25, 2025, Israel sent a truck carrying 88 corpses to Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis without any information regarding their identities. Again, the bodies were buried en masse, leaving desperate families uncertain whether their missing loved ones were among the dead. By destroying all the elements of a normal social life, the genocidal onslaught has blurred the boundary between life and death that is ordinarily ritualized through mourning practices. Hospitals and legal and municipal infrastructures have been mostly obliterated, as are all ordinary family structures and dynamics, as of course is any sense of safety. The division between private and public life is also gone, which means there's no way, for example, that you might go home and grieve a loss in private among the familiar objects and furnishings that give you comfort. Every day for 2 years, we have seen the material ruins of Gaza: apartment buildings, houses, schools, hospitals, water lines, gardens. Aerial photographs show destruction so total it resembles ash, like the leavings of a fire, which if you touched with a finger might crumble softly. The majority of housing is damaged or uninhabitable, and most people are living in tents, vulnerable not only to Israeli firepower, but also to the elements, storms, the freezing cold, poor sanitation. At earlier stages of this horror, there was much talk in the West of witnessing through the screen, of bearing witness, even of the etymological link in Arabic between witness, shahid, and martyr, shahid. The much-witnessed live-stream genocide continued, and the images became, if anything, even more apocalyptic. Witnessing, or looking and weeping, did not stop the atrocities, and the proliferation of images may even have conditioned people to normalize them, as they look at another mangled corpse covered in dust on a phone screen, and then inevitably continue with their day. There have been other genocides in the history of our species. What has made this different seems to be the flagrancy with which it has been conducted, recorded, and abetted. How plainly we see the future continuous with our past. Casual, industrial-scale warfare perpetrated with a lucid sadism, powers that care neither for the earth nor for other human beings, a world increasingly in ruins, dominated by a technocratic elite that considers entire populations disposable and has the power to dispose of them. While atlal in Arabic is close to a word for looking, invoking spectatorship, the word for rubble, anqad, is related to the word for collapsing. Anqad contains a trace of the word that turned it into debris. The root verb naqada can mean to destroy, to demolish, to knock down, to cleave, to burst open, to violate, to break, to breach, to break, to breach, sorry. It can also mean to nullify, to annul, to invalidate, to cancel, to quash, to veto. It is closely related to the word for contradiction, for paradox, for logical incompatibility. There is a world of difference between weeping upon the remnants of an abandoned encampment and staring in horror at the ruins of a refugee camp, or plastic tents bombed by an F-16, or a school on fire. What we see in Gaza are not atlal, they are anqad. They bear the marks of a deliberate violence that does not intend to end until all Palestinian life is rubble. They are not there to be looked at, wept over, and abandoned. According to the Kleinians, the worst pathological consequence of the failure to complete mourning is repetition. The model of the loss is endlessly acted out in psychic life. Certainly, this has already been theorized with respect to Israel's instrumentalizing of Holocaust memory for the purposes of domination and warfare. I'm going to quote someone that Nadia also quoted, Gabriel Winant, who said, "One way of understanding Israel that I think should not be controversial is to say that it is a machine for the conversion of grief into power." The memorializing of the Nazi Holocaust in museums and other forms of pedagogy in the West seems designed to facilitate, in Naomi Klein's words, not remembering, she puts a little dash between the two, referring to dismembering, remembering, but rather re-traumatization. "Looking back," she writes in Doppelganger, "I am struck by what wasn't a part of these strangely mechanical retellings. There was space for the surface-level emotions, horror at the atrocities, rage at the Nazis, a desire for revenge, but not for the more complex and troubling emotions of shame or guilt, or for reflection on what duties the survivors of genocide may have to oppose genocidal logics in all of their forms." This is not mourning. This is a wound kept purposefully open to preclude reflection and justify genocidal violence through the logic and rhetoric of an ontological victimhood. So what about the Palestinians? A friend of mine said recently that they think Palestinians repeat themselves more often than anyone else, that it has been one long repetition of the story since 1948. We tell the same thing again and again. We use the same symbols again and again. It occurs to me to wonder whether in this case, what might be seen as pathological in a clinical context, repetition and other unhealthy expressions of unprocessed grief, are actually normal responses to a pathological situation that had destroyed much of Palestinian social life and therefore of psychic life. Repetition can also be a kind of insistence. "You burn down my house, I will build it again. You kill my parents, I will take up arms." After the so-called ceasefire in January, 300,000 people walked home to the north of Gaza. The Israelis and Americans thought they would never return because so many of their homes had been reduced to rubble, but they insisted on returning. Repetition is a tool against forgetting. Repetition is a kind of return, even if it is only of the repressed. The devastating images that have flooded our screens sometimes galvanize and sometimes stupefy. Meanwhile, writers in Gaza who have somehow managed to produce work during the genocide have provided us with insights beyond the paralyzing visuals. Most of the literary writing is documentary prose, but poets are also managing to work on other kinds of texts. Doha Kahlout's Escaping the Group Photographs, Hurub min Surin Jama'iyya, composed on her phone while living in a shared tent in Deir al-Balah, tracks the gropings of consciousness in the attempt to put the experience of war into language. أسمي الأسماء العاجزة والمعاني المقيدة ألم حصيلة قيد وفكرة ونهر يصب جريان كلماته في غمصوني بعقل الأولين وبجناحين مبتورين قالوا حلقي جثمت وأثقلت ورفضت الإجابات ورفضتني الصور الجماعية. I name the powerless names, the restricted definitions, and a pain resulting from restriction and from thought, with a river that pours a current of words into me, plunges me into the mind of the ancients. With a pair of clipped wings, they say, fly. I crouch, weighed down. I reject the answers. The group photograph rejects me. Deprived of connection, the poetic voice here is alienated. When she tries to speak, drawing on the collective language of her literary heritage, she stumbles. She is forsaken by their old motifs, their names, their images. These no longer serve their purpose, providing neither answers nor social cohesion, nor a sense of poetic lineage or community. It is finally not a ruin nor any other trope or tradition, but a tree that Doha's poem addresses. Not a deserted human habitation, but a living heritage reaching into the earth, from which I dropped at the beginning of time, shajaratan saqattu minha awwal zaman. The tree, deaf and speechless at first, functions as a figure for the family tree, as well as a literal tree growing in the ground. Some trees in Palestine are thousands of years old. They can represent the life of the natural world on a scale much vaster than the span of a single human life. While the speaker cannot fly, she can fall like an apple and become rooted into the earth. She asks this tree, "Who am I?" And the tree is silent. When she asks, "What is war?" And the tree responds, "War is an attempt at immortality and a lust for it." This satisfies her intellectually, but not spiritually. If anything, she is made more alert to her loneliness and the ways she is fenced in by bewilderment, sayjetni adasha. This image of the bewildering fence, siyaj adasha, summons the besieged geography of Gaza, but in this case, it is specifically the poet's mind that is cut off from her literary community, present and historical, as from the category of the human. Giving expression to the fractured consciousness of a person trying to survive genocide, Kahlout's text enacts, at the same time, the mental gestures of trying to overcome the fracturing, to put the shattered pieces together and make sense of the experience. Consolation, safety, or wholeness waves at her from the other side of the fence. Ayatniya tuma'nina, wara'aytuha khalf siyaj ad-dahsha talawahu li. عَرَفُهَا وَعَرِّفُ بِهَا وَلَا تَصِّلُنِي. She recognizes tranquility from afar, but is unable to touch it. "The imagination of the poet is preordained for destruction," wrote Barghouti. "Suddenly, my imagination collapses like a building." The rubble and fragments are not atlal because Gaza is not the past, Gaza is now. And when we talk about the rubble of Gaza, we are also talking about the ruins of the human body. Beneath the cement and plastic and metal, the twisted iron bars of broken reinforced concrete, shrapnel and shattered buildings mixed with flesh. More than 9,500 Palestinian bodies remain trapped by the debris, less than 500 of whom have so far been retrieved for proper burial. Exploded corpses are disinterred in states of such decomposition and dismemberment that they are sometimes impossible to identify. The scholar, who we heard from this morning, Nader Shalhoub Kevorkian, has written of the way fragmented flesh, or ashla, can serve as an analytic for multiple kinds of severance and mutilation, physical but also social, political, epistemic, and historical. Palestinians in Gaza refuse physical and social dismemberment, she tells us, through insisting on their mourning rituals. Despite the Zionist obliteration drive, they collect the fragments of their beloveds, even when they are assembling only a handful of flesh in a plastic shroud. Palestinians are, quote, choosing the path of actual and epistemic reunification through collecting and unifying the ashla, not only of body parts, but also of socially dismembered entities, demanding remembrance and thus livability, end quote. Shalhoub Kevorkian parenthetically pairs the ashla of body parts with the ashla of sociality. The movement of collective mourning, the call, stop and let us weep, has always been separate from psychic life, even while it traces the shape of it. But if looking at the ruins writ large is not yet possible for Palestinians, the insistent repetition of funerary gestures for loved ones are an assertion of presence. If the practice of mourning is a practice of living, then to insist on these rites is to insist on life. Thank you.
Collège de France, le savoir en illimité. Retrouvez tous nos contenus audio et vidéo sur notre site collège-de-france.fr, les plateformes de podcast et nos chaînes YouTube.